So I'm here with Bob Beck. He's managed to avoid the interview in the AC can, but managed to bag him. Bob.
Yeah.
Who are you? What do you do?
I'm Bob Beck. I write software.
Cool. He does. And he's also a pretty good lecturer.
I can get by sometimes.
It flows out of him. Or oozes out of him, I don't know which way it is.
I'd go with ooze.
It's brilliant though. It's
definitely, like, I would go with ooze.
So he has this awesome libTLS tutorial where he can get you from zero to coding in C and doing a TLS encrypted networks, sockets and stuff like that in basically about 15 minutes.
Not 15 minutes. I probably need about 3 hours with you. And you need to know a little bit of C.
Okay.
You need to be able to run the compiler.
You need to be exposed.
And you need to be able to run an editor and change code.
And he does a pretty good job. He did a tutorial and he did 3 hours. But in fairness, it was 15 or 20 minutes into the tutorial and we were already...
Well, if you were fast, you were probably doing the client in about 15 or 20 minutes. If you were quick at it.
The server one was a little bit more involved. But he does a great job on doing it. Bob, what do you do on computers? You say you write software. Who do you write software for? Can you talk about it?
Oh, I write software for myself.
Cool.
That's the only reason to be involved in OpenBSD. I don't write software for other people.
So
I do stuff that interests me.
Okay, and and what stuff interests you?
Well, the stuff that I work on. I've been involved in. Well, I've been involved in OpenBSD for a very long time. I've worked on everything from PF and packet filtering, the odd bits of network driver. I've done a bunch of stuff in userland, be it spamd and a whole variety of userland bits here, there, and everywhere. I've been involved in OpenSSL, libTLS, LibreSSL, the fork. And I've been involved all over the kernel, and like I said, in some of PF and the network stack. I haven't done that as much recently. Little bits and bobs here and there in other random utilities in the kernel. Some of the TTY subsystem, some of a little bit of file system work. A lot of the mid layer, the file system mid layer that I've done a fair bit of churning in. And just about anything between system calls and the file system goes through the buffer cache mid layer, which I've rototilled that money in cache fairly extensively.
And just to point out that Bob has a fantastic talk from one of the previous conferences where you actually talk about the challenges of working on the file system and how dropped packets are fine, but dropped files/directories that generally people are intolerant of that for some reason.
Yeah, they are.
Okay.
It's generally not viewed well.
It's frowned upon. Yeah. So I like it, you say you've been at it for a long time. When did you get involved in the project?
1995, shortly after the first release.
Oh, pretty cool.
Immediately after the first release, basically.
Okay, so, And Bob, what's your favorite piece that you've done that you kind of go, that was me? I did this. For me, not for you guys, by the way. I actually thought he was being generous, but now I just realize he's selfish.
I'm just selfish. It's changed over the years. It really depends, and I think, even some of the things that, quote, I've done, I haven't done. This week my favorite thing is not something I directly did. It's the fact that, hey, look, Robert put unveil into Chrome. And it actually can't get at my SSH keys. That's lovely, and I really, really like that. There's been some of the things that I've really liked to do that I've done. Actually, the one that I particularly like, which nobody ever sees or notices, is the name cache. And if you're not aware of what that is, I've done, as probably most people know, I've done a bunch of work in the file system with the buffer cache to make it actually larger and use larger amounts of memory, particularly on machine on AMD64 machines with more than 4 gigabytes of memory. That wasn't as interesting as the name cache, because the name cache used to be effectively a fixed size, and it's used to rapidly look up file to vNode. And when you're looking at the file system and you're trying to say, oh, I looked up Etsy password, and the Etsy password is this vNode, rather than having to read from the disk, read the directory vNode, and go and find that, you can actually cache in the mid layer, hey, this name is this, this name is this. In memory, which is used to be a small fixed size hash that was global to the file system.
Okay.
So you would have this little fixed size hash that was and so it didn't hold a lot of things. And I decided that was kind of silly. And we got rid of the fixed size hash and needed a red black tree hanging off of every vNode that was dynamically allocated as the thing for red, and if it was a directory vNode, so that you just had that sitting there waiting for stuff to pick it up. And so that one I'm particularly proud of.
Okay, so that it just faster worked. And more scalable.
It just worked, yeah.
Pretty cool.
It hasn't had too many problems. And then, you know, I did that one so long ago, every so often I go back, it's like, oh yeah, I remember this. Oh yeah, I did that.
Like that, okay, cool.
And, yeah. So, I mean, there's been a few.
Okay, and if there was one thing you'd change about OpenBSD, what would it be?
I don't know. If I wanted to change it, I would change it.
Boom. See, that adds interest to the town.
You know, there's always things that, you know, would be better. The question is that you know, is there time and effort, okay, you know, for people that would work on it and do those things? And so, you know, I'm not one of those that goes, oh, you know, I wish it would change. I wish we have a better file system. I wish we had this. I wish we had that. Well, then go do it. you know, literally go do it. You may have seen some people more vocally on the lists, or some people just, you know, folderize the lists away with, you know, frankly, users going, oh, when are we going to have this? When are we going to have ZFS? When are we going to have Hammer 2? And, you know, it's shut up and hack, you know. Yeah, you know, don't sit and whine about it or feel entitled. I mean, you know, we do this because it's interesting to us, or it's a feature we want. You know, the developers are volunteers, and you know, if you've got an interest in having that in there, then contribute.
Yeah.
Then you know.
So either fund the developers to do it,
or start writing code.
Okay, cool. And like you mentioned, it's your lecturer. Or you have been a lecturer
in a past life.
And being honest, I was subjected to the libDLS tutorial, and I have to say it was really enjoyable, and I mean that, and I'm not blowing smoke up your, you know, it was more that it was clear that you've done this before, and it was actually very good. Have you ever considered doing more of that, or maybe online feature requests and just dropping in on them now?
Like a
lecture series?
I guess I have. Part of the reason is I did the libTLS one the way I did was to see if I could actually use effectively, because it's in GitHub, to use GitHub the way I did to make that, you know, that with exercises and solutions to the exercises available in a format that people could use. So in some sense, I'm kind of thinking about that in the back of my mind of, can I do other things with that? You know, do I have anything ready to go that I've decided to do in that yet? No, but maybe, but you know, there's also a difference between, you know, teaching material and then, you know, how you present it. So
true. And like,
will I give the tutorial again if people want me to? I suppose, but
like so, can you describe how you use Git? Because it was actually like, I'm not a huge Git user, clearly, because I'm more of a network engineer as opposed to a developer. So when I was there, and to be honest, I just did it because I went, hey, it's Bob Beck, and libTLS, I'm actually interested in it. Mm-hmm. And it was really cool. So I went from not having coded in 20 years since college, and it is 20 years ago this year, this month actually. yeah, so I moved it swiftly on, getting old. But yeah, so basically, can you describe how you use Git? Because it was pretty impressive how it structured the tutorial.
Well, it was really, really more of a case of being able to say, okay, if you use this Git clone here, copy the little URL from GitHub, copy it out, clone the repository, now you have all the code. There's a few branches, I just tell you, here's how to check out that branch, now you're looking at the solution to this, here's how to check out this branch, that's how to look at the solution to this, and we can look at it ourselves on the monitor by examining the diff in GitHub. That's really all there is to it. And so it's not really anything like the strength of Git, if anything, it's just because I have GitHub available. So it makes kind of a ready-made presentation tool to go over the differences to see a solution. Yeah. And that was really what I was using it for, is to basically, in front of the class, be able to review a diff with people on a web page.
And it was pretty cool in that, basically what Bob did in that tutorial was he took basically a clear text client and a clear text server, and then said, right, within 20 lines of code, in around that, 18 to 20 lines of code,
about you can that make in each it, site.
You can make, yeah, in each site, fair enough. You could actually make it like TLS encrypted with libRESSL, which would mean that you actually have a quite a secure, or as secure as possible, I suppose, cryptography library than you. So why do people make a bags of it and try and write loads of lines of code?
Well, don't forget, libTLS is pretty new. So most of our new stuff in OpenBSD that uses TLS, we write using that API. There is a large established code base out there that uses the old OpenSSL way of doing things, and so that's, you know, that's still supported in libRESSL. It's still there, and you know, there's no real plans to jump away from it anytime soon because so much software is using it.
Yeah. Okay. And what about so you've seen you did work on the file system, you did work all over the place. What is the one that's a chore for you that you go, Jesus, do I have to do this? But you have to do it for yourself.
NFS. NFS. Every goddamn time I have to touch NFS.
And NFS is you know, rather famously makes people scream.
Because
it touches... It kind of exists as a massive layering violation in the kernel between the network stack and the mid layer and sort of the file system. And so it makes you, it can have some very interesting and bizarre corner cases. And we've had a lot of things happen over the years with NFS that, you know, make you tear your hair out when you try to make a change that breaks NFS. And breaking NFS breaks OpenBSD's infrastructure because we depend on it for builds. So you can't, you know, if you break NFS, you break builds, you break snapshots, and you know, things don't work. And so, you know, that NFS is kind of a pain in the butt.
Okay, cool. I'm just gonna check and make sure we're still in frame, because sometimes it kind of creeps away, not still working. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So, okay, so we covered it here. Also, Bob does a great talk, or did a great talk. I think it was 1 month and 30 days of libRESSL.
No, that was a long time ago.
It was still an awesome talk, though.
Well, that'd have been an awesome talk, but no.
What have you done in the last 1,000 days of libRESSL?
It's been an awful lot, that last 1,000 days of libRESSL. Yeah, definitely, hardly, not the least of which, not all by me. There's been, you know, a whole bunch of actually improvements to libTLS that actually made what we do in that tutorial possible. Because that was all done after the split from libRESSL. Basically, you're remembering my impromptu talk at BSD CAN, which was really was 30 days after we said, heck with it, we're forking it.
Yeah.
You know, since then, we've added all of libTLS to that, to libRESSL. So all of that has been added in. A whole bunch of stuff has been taken out. Portable has happened since that time. So, you know, when I gave that talk, there wasn't a portable version of libRESSL. There is now, and it works on Linux, on Windows, on Mac OS, on Solaris, on pretty much everything anybody would actually care about. You know, sorry, there's no VMS support. there's no EBCDIC, so no IBM mainframe support, but for most things that people care about, you can elaborate on that. So that's, you know, all changed since then. And there's been a lot of under the covers handling of what's going on in the library, particularly in the SSL state machine, to make a lot of the, you know, the buffer handling for parsing as in one, and how you pull stuff off the wire in a certificate format, which is, you know, it's usually length prefix encoded, and we're using a different way of doing that than OpenSSL does, than OpenSSL does, mainly to make that safer and just get rid of the crazy amounts of pointer arithmetic that's done in that code.
Okay, cool. And is a part of your approach to try and make cryptography easier for people to actually use without making a bag zipper or making mistakes?
I mean, cryptography is sort of a bad word for that. You know, most of the issues with libTLS have not been, I mean, sure, there have been a few, you know, errors in the actual cryptographic implementation, you know, where you have a weak key problem, or, you know, you have side channel attacks on cryptography and things like that. But by far, what tends to get the most attention in, you know, problems associated with it, we historically say, oh, OpenSSL has had issues. It's not that. It is actually issues in classic, you know, C programming and programming defensively, when really what it comes down to of just handling untrusted input, of basically string handling. Most of TLS is not cryptography. Most of the hard work in setting up a TLS session is not the turning on AES. It's not the validating an EC key. That's relative. Once you have the pieces, that's a function call. It is, oh, I've gotten these bits over the wire, packed up in this serialization format of as in one, and I'm supposed to do that in this way and change state here, 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 and here. I'm supposed to send this, then send this, and if I get this, I do this. If not, I do this. And so it's that basic state machine and string parsing and handling all the corner cases and all the edge cases and what happens in an error case and what happens if memory allocation fails and what happens if somebody, instead of doing what you thought they were going to do and sending you the next state, sends you something bizarrely different to try to make your state machine go bananas. So it's those kind of errors that have, you know, people think, oh, you know, it's a cryptography error. It's not. It's effectively, it's, you know, the standard, you know, it's a standard error in programming something that is complicated and not handling, you know, edge cases and untrusted input.
And how are you finding, let's say, from a performance point of view, do you do a lot of work in trying to keep that working in a performant manner, or, like, you know, like compared, let's say, comparing it to the old OpenSSL type setup?
Probably pointedly, yes and no. We do look at the assembly language implementations that they have, and we've tried to make use of that. Yod and a few others have made some improvements to those, but by and large, if the choice is between, you know, code we can read, code we can audit, code we can know is correct, and free of side channel attacks, versus code that runs faster, we're going to opt for the former.
Yeah.
So, you know, yes, we want it to be performant, but we don't want it to be, you know, so performant that it actually has security issues. So,
point taken.
Yeah, case in point. To the other, if you want to talk about something that I'm quote proud of, unquote, I believe, what was it? About a year and a half ago in Brisbane, Billy Brumley sent us an issue that I believe they sent to OpenSSL at the same time, which was, hey, look, you know, this, and this in RSA is, you know, in their the way that they did Montgomery multiply in the big number library is subject to a side channel timing attack because they're not doing constant time big number multiplication operations. Like, oh, that's interesting. Well, unless you explicitly requested constant time in the library, you would get the default one, which was not constant time. And I looked at that, and yeah, they described a way to do the constant time Montgomery multiply, and I looked at that, and yep, I can do that with this, and there we go. Got that, got it to pass the regression test, and then went through the standard multiply and this and that. And so I basically went through and changed the big number operations in libRSSL so that the default, if you did not specify anything, was constant time. And if you did not specify, if you actually explicitly asked for the non-constant time version, then fine. Supposedly you know what you're doing. Okay. But, you know, and then I audited use of it in the library to say, okay, constant time everywhere we think it matters, except where it probably doesn't. And, you know, that was fixed a year, year and a half.
That actually
before OpenSSL bothered to fix it. I think just simply because there was a bit of a miscommunication, I think, in their part. And I mean, they eventually did fix it, but it was more of a case of, oh, you know, obviously, take this and reverse it around, and actually, hey, make it safe by default. If you know, you know, sure, if you absolutely know that you're not dealing with private key material and you're not dealing with something that can be looked at, and there's an advantage to someone to time this operation and tell what's going on, then great. You can choose to do the non-constant time version, but by default, if you're doing big number operations, they're done in constant time. It makes DC a little slower.
Okay.
DC, the desk calculator, the command line application that you can type numbers into, that actually uses the big number library.
Okay.
And it's a little bit slower because it does constant time math.
What sort of percentages?
I didn't bother to measure it because I didn't care.
Okay. Well, you mentioned something about, and it kind of belies the approach that you found a potential problem or a potential way of sidechain attack.
And then I didn't find it really broken.
No, someone else found it, but then you went, right, okay, this conceptually can be applied in other areas in the US. And so you basically, when you
found, I wouldn't say it was necessarily other areas in the OS. It was the noticing that the reason that this is an issue in the first place is that there is this non-constant time version of the big number operation, and that the default is to always use the non-constant time, the fastest version possible. And the obviously, you know, when you're dealing with stuff that is a security sensitive library, that it's the same default is no. Always try to use the constant time version, unless you're certain otherwise. So the default should be safe, not the other way around.
And so you basically said, right, we found this issue, so now let's look at anywhere else that might use the big number operations, make sure to use constant time. And that kind of belies kind of an approach that you always take, that if you find a problem, which sometimes you, I think you've talked about in libRSSL.
If you find one problem and you see that this is, if you know, if this is a whole class, fix all of them. Don't fix the individual one. Find the programming paradigm that leads to why the mistake was made. It's not just that somebody made a mistake. Why was that mistake made? And you know, that's why
how we need to get through the audit process.
Let's not just how this child gets to the audit process, because an audit process is not going to catch everything ever. It is a case of, oh, we audited this, and look, case in point, this is how Sterel copy came into being. Look, why does this keep happening? Because Ster copy is unsafe, and Ster end copy is weird. And no, let's have one that's easy for people to use, that makes sense and makes the error checking and the building of other strings sensible. And if we use this paradigm instead of the older ones, it's less error prone.
Okay.
And so it really is about, you know, when we look at these things, say, hey, what's the way that people could stop making this mistake? And then sweep through the tree, find all the old way of doing it, change them to the new way of doing it.
Cool. And you're working on all Unveil and with Sebastian Marie, Theo. Would that be
the Unveil crew is mainly at least at first it was me, Theo, and Semmery doing most of that. And I think now it's expanded out. Robert's been poking me a bit with a stick, and I think as we get a few more programs unveiled, I think there's going to be more people in the port history involved in trying to use Unveil in the Port Street, particularly to, you know, do things like what's been done with Chrome. Particularly because in some cases there are programs out there that, you know, are hard or not even possible to use something like Pledge with, but you can still get some limited benefit of constraining them somewhat by using Unveil. Mm-hmm. So I think we'll see more involvement from the likes of the Ports people and stuff with that.
Cool.
As that progresses along.
Cool. And does Bob have do you have spare time in your hands, or are you looking for funding for any pet projects or anything?
I don't have spare time on my hands.
Are we looking for funding for pet projects? I can think of people I would love to fund. I don't know if that's necessarily a topic for here, but we're always looking for stuff like that.
Cool. And that's fair enough. We'll talk about that again. I suppose, how would you, like, for people at home who kind of are starting to use OpenBSD or considering starting to use OpenBSD, how can they actually help the project, help you help them, help me?
Me. So, first of all, donate. Probably the best thing individuals can do for donation is set up a regularly recurring PayPal donation. That's the easiest thing that we can actually use that works in Canada, in the US, and around the world. And if there was a better option, we might consider it. But just set up a recurring PayPal donation. That's the easiest way for individuals. If you have contacts at larger companies, ask them or put them in touch with the foundation members about making a contribution to the foundation from a company.
And a regular contribution
every year.
That would be helpful.
Yeah, because SmartSend have phoned us a fair bit more.
SmartSend have, and I believe they are attempting to again this year.
That's pretty awesome.
From what
respect.
Hopefully that'll show up soon.
No, that's pretty cool. I do a regular personal donation. And what I've been saying internally in our own company, the discussions were, they were like, we'll wait till we're actually making money off it first.
I understand that, and that's you know.
But the other side of it, I kind of think is, like, for instance, like one of our use cases, which was it was a bad way to start. If you're going to start using OpenBSD, don't pick a really stable, rock solid thing, because you won't learn anything about OpenBSD, because to set it up, 5 years later, it still works, and you're like, oh, I didn't learn anything in this.
Well, but backing away from the donation part of it, you know, the other thing that users can do is A, keep their machines relatively current. B, when they run into a problem, don't just say, I've ran into a problem. Spend your time and look at, what do I need to send so that people can diagnose the problem.
The message, K-Tracer, it didn't happen.
K-Trace is helpful. With kernel crashes, it actually says right in a web page, you know, when you see that, if you see a kernel crash, it says, hey, go to this URL, find your phone, go to that URL and read what it says to do. Do that. You know, that is what you should do to report bugs. If you have bugs in user land software or issues, you know, be specific and report them specifically. And far better yet, take a stab at fixing it yourself. Send a diff. It might be wrong, it might be right, it doesn't matter. That gets you involved in the process. So
that's pretty cool. Hence,
I don't know if you went to Todd Mortimer's talk.
Todd Mortimer's talk was pretty awesome.
And he was only brought into the project basically a year and a half ago. But you notice what, you know, here's the example to use. Sure, I've been involved forever, Todd hasn't, but Todd said, oh, I've figured out how all of these ROP gadgets work.
Yes.
And I went to Theo and said, I think we could do this. And Theo looked like he didn't believe me, but he said, please go ahead and try. And he did. And he started having success at this. And this is how people get involved in the project.
Yeah. Like, it was very impressive, his talk. Basically talking about ROP, like, well, I'm not a programmer, so I kind of got a rough idea of how it was working, but I wasn't going to attempt, you know, to string a few gadgets together and exploit a system, but it was a really good talk, and he actually literally had And I have to say, Theo and Bob, the lads here, are very approachable. If you talk shite, they'll probably call you out on that, which is, it's allowed. It's in fact encouraged. Particularly, like, they have to sometimes pull me aside and just say, you know, time to talk shit. No, but they don't, they're awesome guys. Go and cut this part. But basically, like, yeah, you go up and discuss an idea. Like, even when I was asking one about the B2B, like, trying to compare two full tables on the internet, and I've thought about it for a while, and then I said, fuck it, I'm just going to write the thing and say, how do we approach this? What's the feedback? What am I missing?
Yeah.
And then see what people come back.
But let's not forget, discuss an idea doesn't mean get on the mailing list and ask the developers to teach you how it works. We don't have time for that shit. Discuss an idea is do your homework.
Yeah.
You read up on it. You read the code. Ask intelligent questions. You know, show that you have actually thought about it. You've looked at how we do it. You have gone into the code and looked, or you've gone out there and you've done your research, as opposed to just, well, how does this work? Teach me. No.
No, it's more like, and in my defense on that one, I had researched, I hadn't looked at the code because I've been standing in the field of thistles, as we would say in Ireland. But it may as well be, you know. But it was more like, okay, well, I understand how the protocol works, I understand what I'm trying to achieve, and I want to know if there are any edge cases that I'm not considering that actually would cause more, as in, does the idea cause more problems than it solves? Here's, you know, and ultimately my aim for that one was, okay, what's involved in it? How much is it going to cost then? When can we start coding it? Or if someone says, we're not that interested, but you can have a go. Like the way, like to be fair with Theo, like he said, have a go. He gave the guy a chance to make a difference, and he's made a significant difference on Rock, which, as Theo said in his previous presentation in EuroBSDCon last year, was one of the pre-rock, it was one of the most frightening papers you've ever read in computer science, and Todd just stepped up and said, I can help with that one.
I think I can fix that.
That's pretty awesome. And like, cool. Do the simple stuff, you know, documentation, help with that. And you will, like, there's an attention to detail that's required in the project, which I actually really respect and like, because if you have the attention to detail, then it allows me a little bit more flexibility in what I do. So you do the hard work.
Well, there's also a thing that people somewhat don't realize often about project, is that when we get picky, if you will, about, you know, we start pushing things upstream to make sure that, programs, when we do things like put in return guard and stack protector, and then we compile the ports tree and we discover that ports explode with these features on them because they've got bugs in them. When those features are then picked up and upstream from the ports tree and fixed, well, that fixes them for everybody, not just for OpenBSD. So when you have, tooling and a ports tree in OpenBSD building with, aggressive security mitigations, and when those are used to find bugs, and those bugs are patched in our ports tree, but when the ports tree people fix them, push those fixes upstream, that helps everybody.
Yeah.
So it helps everybody that uses that package. Even if you're not running it on OpenBSD, but if you're running it on Windows or Windows or Linux or Solaris or something like that.
So it's like what Todd
didn't I just have a little brain fart there and say Windows? Linux really is the new Windows.
Is it?
Yeah, Linux is the new Windows. Yeah, it's the new Windows.
Well, actually, it has quite a fan base in Microsoft. You know?
Yeah, and it has all the fun security problems of Windows 95. because now it will never be patched ever, because everyone will run old ones in containers forever.
Okay, and yeah, like containers, actually, yeah, no, there was some interesting, like, you know the way, there was one thing I liked, because I followed the OpenBSD or stalked privately for a while without knowing anyone, and I remember, like, Theo didn't like virtualization But then he kind of saw the merits to it, I suppose, or used them. But he still obviously has all its security flaws. Mm-hmm. So you're still, you're kind of pursuing it and trying to make it more secure mm-hmm. than the current, let's say, options out there. Mm-hmm. And as Rake says, it breaks his heart to run OpenBSD on basically Linux systems. You know, he's got, oh, Jesus, there has to be a better way.
Well, I mean, yes and no. It's unfair. It might break your heart to run OpenBSD on a Linux system. But to put that another way, if you want to have something to do utility function within your router, like Cisco, and a high-end Cisco has a way to run a VM machine to do that in it, and you can run whatever you want, guess what? That actually means you can run OpenBSD to do that stuff in your Cisco router.
That is pretty cool.
And that's a pretty cool thing to be able to do.
Absolutely. So, and it's nice to be presenting the OpenBSD system to the internet, even, and so you have the security mitigations as much as possible in the OS itself. Mm-hmm. One last, I'm going to, sorry, because we're all getting restless here, but on the conference, which was your favorite talk, apart from your own?
I have to say Todd's, only because I really like Ingo's talk, but I saw Ingo's talk in Canada as well, because he did it in Ottawa. He's very, you know, he's updated it a bit. Todd's is my favorite. Ingo's is always my most favorite as compared to the title, because I think Ingo always makes his title about documentation, which he is doing documentation, but then when you really go look at what he's doing, he's actually finding bugs. And to me, that's the interesting part.
The way he describes the joke. It's a bug. Bad documentation is a bug.
Well, it's not just bad documentation is a bug. He goes to document something and then finds out that it has bugs because he's documenting.
That's pretty cool.
So.
But he has an amazing attention to detail. And that's what I love about the project. And I'm cool. It's right now, some trying things. Just not us. No, that's cool. No, that's brilliant.
Okay.
When did you start using computers? When did Bob actually?
Oh, God, I don't remember.
Yeah, as a kid. That was a long time ago.
Cool. So. You're still a bit of a kid.
Are we all?
Yeah, absolutely. Bob, thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Keep it up, and pleasure. Thank you.